Hi. Today, the end of an era. Angela Merkel is stepping down as chair of her party after confirming that she won't stand for re-election again when her term as chancellor ends. So what is her legacy for Germany and for Europe? Plus, in opinion, Rania Mustafa Ali, a Syrian refugee, on overcoming stereotypes in her new life in Vienna. Angela Merkel is very powerful and influential, and she's often referred to as the mother of Germany. Is she still that figure to people in the country?
Yes. I mean, sometimes it's been a bit sort of ironically meant, Mutti der Nation, mother of the nation, Mutti Merkel. And what is interesting is that in the past, we used to hear people at rallies, they'd see Angie, they'd hold up placards with her name on it. And now the slogan that you hear more and more at rallies is Merkel muss weg, Merkel must go.
After dominating European politics for over a decade, today Angela Merkel steps aside and a new leader of her party, the Christian Democratic Union, is elected. Whoever is chosen will be the frontrunner to succeed her as German Chancellor when her term ends in 2021. And Merkel has proven that leading Europe's largest economy is a role that shapes more than just Germany's future.
There was the Euro crisis and the refugee crisis, both of which have really changed the EU and really shaped the EU as we know it now.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesan. Today in Focus, as the mother of Germany begins to relinquish power, how have Angela Merkel's decisions altered the path of the European Union? Kate, how long have you been in Germany?
Too long. I've certainly seen Merkel come and I will see her go, I hope.
Kate Connolly is The Guardian's Berlin correspondent.
Angela Merkel, is a very pragmatic leader, a very prudent woman.
Some expect my speech to pave the way for a fundamental reform of the European architecture. I'm afraid they are in for a disappointment.
Somebody who calls a spade a spade. On the two or three occasions that I've met her for interviews, she's very friendly, quite shy. I know that might sound odd, but quite a shy woman, quite likes to crack a joke, quick-witted, extremely sponge-like in her ability to just soak up all the information around her, whether you're talking about the political situation in Syria or the Minsk agreement. What was unfortunate is that if you did an interview with her, the German rules are that the interview then has to go through an authorization process. So you submit the answers back to her office and they will then decide what is allowed to be the official version of the interview.
Really? And I had no idea that happened in Germany.
Yes, that happens. It makes working here often a bit challenging. What you can then try to do is allude to certain things that she has said, but not directly quoting her. So I remember one interview that we did with her. It was a round table and somebody said to her, what job would she like to do if she wasn't the chancellor? And she said she would love the idea of running a job centre. She just thought that would be the most exciting position that she could have. And when the authorised version of the interview came back, that detail had been removed, which I thought was, I thought it was a shame. And of course, I did manage in that case to put it in indirectly in the feature that we did.
Running a job centre does say quite a lot about Merkel, because it's about logistics, it's practical, but also ultimately, I suppose, it's about helping people.
Yes, I think so. I think she would say that she'd mainly take a pragmatic approach to things, but I think that her background as a pastor's daughter, I know you can over exaggerate that. Theresa May sometimes gets tarred with that brush as well, but I think that it certainly has shaped somehow the way that Merkel reacts to things that happen, that sort of human approach to things over the refugee crisis. She said, how could I have reacted any differently? You know, these people needed our help. So therefore, of course, I allowed them to come in.
Seems June was a record month for migrant relocations in Europe, according to the EU Commission. It says that 3,000 new arrivals were moved to other countries, bringing the total number to 24,000.
Where are you going?
Outside Budapest train station, migrants voiced their frustration.
There were thousands of refugees stranded at Hungary's main station in the summer of 2015. And she viewed this as a humanitarian disaster, potentially, that was going to happen in the EU. And so as a gesture of her solidarity and a sort of humanitarian gesture, that's how she put it, she said that these people should come into Germany. And of course, she didn't go to the Bundestag to get a mandate for that. Neither did she go to the EU.
So was there a particular moment that you think persuaded her to take such decisive action on this?
A lot of people would document her first real contact with what was going on to a meeting that she had in July of that year with a Palestinian refugee who had been living in Lebanon, who had come to Germany. And she was called Reem Sahwil. And Merkel met her, and the girl told her that she had no sense of a perspective. She was learning German, and I think that she even faced being returned. And she burst into tears during this encounter with Merkel. Now, Merkel patted her on the back and said something like, we can't take everybody, and you need to understand that. She was accused then of being cold. And then later on, she made the decision then a couple of months later that Germany would actually open its borders.
I mean, she just sort of literally opened up all the borders and welcomed thousands and thousands of migrants and just said, her kind of reaction was, we will cope.
Yes, wir schaffen das, which is kind of now you use it with friends in a sort of ironic way, roll the eyeballs way when you're sort of, you know, in a sticky, maybe sticky personal situation or something, and you know, you're sort of talking to your neighbour, and then people say wir schaffen das, we'll manage it. Everybody knows when you say that, you know, that's a reference back to 2015, and I think there were a lot of mayors across Germany and who really were really annoyed about her for making that claim. Because effectively it wasn't her who had to manage it so much as it was people in small communities, particularly in, say, Bavaria, who literally woke up one morning and found, refugees in their gardens or knocking at the door asking for water. It was a really sort of in-your-face encounter. I don't know that she really ever did go to any of these small places and actually feel the impact.
I went to Hamburg, which is the city of her birth, in 2015 to cover the migrant crisis.
Is there something in Germany you're really excited about doing?
I want to visit many cities.
And I do remember arriving in the Bahnhof in Hamburg, and the station was just full of these volunteers and people arriving, and lots of people sort of celebrating this idea that here they are, and, you know, really grateful, like this sort of gratitude towards Germany and Mama Merkel, as like loads of them kept on using that phrase, like, thank you, Mama
thank
Merkel.
Thank you, Mama Merkel. Thank you, Mama Merkel. And
but it was quite clear, actually, that once they got there, that Hamburg wasn't really set up to support all of these people, and things became very difficult, not just for people in Hamburg, but also the migrants who were there.
Nothing here. No life.
What did you think Germany would be like? What did you expect from Germany?
I don't know. Angela Merkel. Yes.
Yeah.
Why he say come people Syria here? Why? For this is life? Why?
It was a shock to the country, wasn't it?
Nothing in Germany was really set up to deal with this. So the authorities that deal with migration and the asylum claims just completely sort of overwhelmed by the task that they had. And there have been lots of mistakes that have been made as a result of that. A lot of safety concerns about people who have come with criminal records and been allowed in and then have committed crimes here, often very violent crimes, or have basically been convicted here of a crime, and then there's no way to send them back to anywhere, that's caused a huge amount of disgruntlement. And that is a point that the AfD makes every time it stands up in the Bundestag.
And that's the far-right party.
That's Germany. the far-right party that came into government after last September's elections and are the main opposition party in the government.
Was this a surprising moment of empathy from her? Is she in general quite an empathetic person?
I think Merkel is quite an empathetic person. I mean, she's quite hard-nosed. You know, I think she'd have to be in that role. But this was a woman who grew up in rural communist East Germany with her father's parsonage, its doors always open to people. And, you know, you don't want to sort of extend these sort of metaphors too much. But I think she herself has said it enabled her to think when this, think in the grander scale when this crisis happened in 2015 for her. It was a logical step because that's what she knew.
She has also been known for her much more pragmatic approach, the word that's used all the time in relation to Merkel. So, for example, in 2010, Greece was in a lot of financial trouble and she famously really dug her heels in. Remind us what was happening, Kate.
So, yes, the biggest test of Merkel's chancellorship to date came in the shape of Greece and its debt troubles. And it appeared that the Greek economy was in huge difficulty.
Reflecting widening concerns, European markets opened sharply down on Wednesday morning. The euro reached a fresh one-year low against the dollar. Along with the stench of Greek economic decay, now comes the fear of contagion.
What is at stake is certainly today the economic situation of Greece, but it's more than that.
And there was a really strong sense of this economic divide within the eurozone. Merkel was seen to be at the head of the initiative or the push for countries like Greece to really rein in that debt and introduce huge, tough austerity measures, which were devastating to a lot of Greeks.
There were huge protests in Athens and around the country, weren't there? I remember them.
When you have done it all your life, gotten your degrees, done everything you could do, and now it's totally out of your hands, what else can you do?
There were a lot of protests in which Angela Merkel and her economics minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, were depicted as Nazis or figures of the SS. You know, that there was a lot of pressure on her to back down. And this image of Germany being this sort of scolding master, saying that, you know, you've spent beyond your means, you now need to tighten the belt, you can't just depend on Europe the whole time to bail you out. That was the Merkel way of looking at it, but of course it was viewed in these countries and also elsewhere in the continent as this very heavy-handed, rather cold-hearted, you know, the failure to sort of see the real tragedies that were happening on the ground.
Does she still stand by this decision she made on Greece?
She does still stand by it because she says, you know, the point is you can't spend beyond your means. And so from her pragmatic point of view, bear in mind, this is the woman who, when she left her first husband, I think it was in the 70s, she took the washing machine with her. You know, when she walked out the door, she walked out on him, took the washing machine, which she'd presumably paid for with her hard-earned cash during the communist years, and she took it with her.
That's very pragmatic.
Yeah, very pragmatic.
But also, fair enough. And we do know that she lives in quite an ordinary flat in Berlin. She's often in the local supermarket. And her second husband, who's a chemistry professor, he keeps a very low profile. Is she just pretty down to earth?
I think she is. I mean, she always talks about, you know, quite enjoying making potato soup. When she goes on holiday every year with her husband, I think they normally go to Italy and they go on a walking holiday. And every year we get the same picture of her and her husband on the chairlift in the mountains, looking like a couple of ordinary tourists.
We've talked about the refugee crisis and how she handled Greece's financial collapse. And these are two huge moments. So when her chancellorship ends in 2021, what sort of a mark do you think she'll have left on the European Union?
I think in some ways her standing down from Europe, you know, a lot of people will see it as a huge relief. They think that she has been, is somebody who's done quite a lot of damage to Europe. That's the way a lot of the leaders who are actually in power at the moment would see it, from Sebastian Kurz in Austria to Viktor Orban in Hungary. I think that they will be quite happy that she has gone. It will certainly be a new era for Europe. It will she, you know, she promised, for example, that she would foster European unity, that she would look to reform the Eurozone, and wanted to have more political integration. Of course, there are a lot of people in the UK who would say if that is one reason, the indication that that was going to happen is one reason why Brexit happened, because in Britain we weren't prepared to go along with deeper integration. We had Emmanuel Macron come onto the scene. He was really keen on European reform. And there were a lot of expectations when that happened that he and Merkel together would instigate reform, that Germany would kind of jump over its shadow and accept maybe sort of more, to become more of a risk taker. But I think that the more and more that governments have been elected that seem to be heading in another direction, she's been very sceptical of taking too many bold steps. In many ways, maybe it will be easier for Europe to take some sort of steps to improve its situation when she's not there. But I feel that maybe the way in which she's been able to bring people together, you know, even if she hasn't done it to the extent that we would have wanted her to, that maybe chances have been lost, and maybe that momentum will go when Merkel goes.
Angela Merkel's plan is to stay on as Chancellor until 2021, because even though the Chancellor is normally the chair of the largest party in the Bundestag, it's not actually a binding rule. And this wouldn't be the first time this slightly odd situation has happened. And today, voting takes place for her replacement as leader of the CDU party. And that person could potentially be the next Chancellor of Germany. Kate, who's in the running?
So we have three possibilities. So we have, let me call her, cautiously call her the front runner. Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, otherwise known as AKK, because most Germans can't pronounce her name. She is sometimes talked about as Merkel's crown princess because Merkel has kind of nurtured her in the party. I think she's 56. So a strong candidate to take over from Merkel. We have in the second candidate, Friedrich Merz, who left politics about 10 years ago and joined the banking industry, has since become, I think it's fair to say, a multimillionaire. He has two private jets. So quite a contrast to the sort of the Merkel, exactly the sort of more frugal Merkel. And then we have Jens Spahn.
Die eine ist in der Krankenpflege, in den Krankenhäusern wird jede zusätzliche
Who is the current health minister. He's 38 years old. He is somebody who has been talked about for several years as a potential successor to Merkel, but he's not won much support in recent months because of his arrogant, sort of what's been perceived as sort of slightly arrogant stance.
And once the CDU has a new leader, won't power sort of start to leech away from her? Could her departure come a bit sooner than we think?
It could very well be. And as we've talked about, I mean, it could be that the new CDU leader will not get on with the chancellor. So if it's AKK and Merkel, we can expect that would be a pretty smooth working relationship. But if it's Merkel in the chancellery and it's Friedrich Merz as the CDU leader, that could cause a lot of problems. And I think that that will be something that the delegates will be thinking of. How will this affect the last 3 years of the CDU, of our CDU chancellor? And also they need to think longer term about which candidate will make the party most attractive to the electorate. And in a way, they're two quite different questions. So it'll be very interesting to see how people justify or how they make the decisions that they make.
Brilliant, Kate. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
You can follow the results of the vote and all of Kate Connolly's reporting at theguardian.com. Coming up next, after 2 years living in Europe, Rania Mustafa Ali discusses her struggle to escape the word refugee. Welcome back. 2 years ago, 20-year-old Rania Mustafa Ali filmed her journey from the ruins of Kobani in Syria to Vienna in Austria.
Assalamu alaikum.
Her footage was made into a Guardian documentary, and a year on from the film, Rania reflects on beginning her new life in Europe and the welcome she'd expected.
I left Syria in January 2016, and the reason that why I left the country was that in July 2015, ISIS committed a massacre in Kobani, and I was there. To be honest, that was the one that just pushed all the buttons that made me leave the country. There were many scary moments in that journey, but probably the worst and the most difficult one was crossing the Mediterranean. I can't swim at all, and I was in a rubber boat full of kids and women, and I mean all vulnerable people, old people. And when it was sinking, I haven't said to my father that I didn't say to him that I'm leaving tomorrow, for example. And so I didn't get to say goodbye. And I think that was the most difficult thing and the most scary phase in the whole journey. I was seeing all those videos that being posted on social media and Facebook from the German, a lot of from the German people from Germany and from the volunteers who are waiting on the beach in Lesbos or any Greek island, and the way they were helping people, greeting them, all those welcome signs in many European cities. I didn't expect that necessarily, but I was expecting kindness. So when I got to Vienna, it wasn't like this. There was no such thing, no welcoming committee, no group coming to pick me up, take me somewhere. There was a phase that happened where everything is about refugees. Everyone is talking about it. Right now, it shifted. It changed to people just being tired of it, bored of keep listening and hearing about it. Or like some parties in Europe and some governments used it as a tool to win a political game, because refugees basically they were their scapegoat. They wanted to win the elections, and that was the way, using people's fears against them, and the way that they used it was refugees. So when people are talking about refugees, there's only two narratives. One is demonizing them and the other is victimizing them. But no one actually ever talked to me and asked me about it. I consider myself very well integrated, but until this right now, someone would talk to me very normally. And at the moment that I say I'm from Syria, everything has changed. I think it's, is she a terrorist? What did she do there in Syria? Why is she alone here? Where's her family? Is she working? It actually feels really unfair, because how come anyone has the right to talk and describe someone's identity when it's not their own? My identity is uniquely my own, and I only have the right to describe it. No one else has the right to do it. And if someone wants to know, just come and ask me.
You can watch Escape from Syria, Rania's Odyssey, at theguardian.com. That's it for today and for the week. Let us know what you're making of Today in Focus. Leave a review. And of course, if you feel like it, do subscribe. Today's producers were Rachel Humphreys and Leah Green, and sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you next week.